Spike Wilner.
Hello.
It's so great to have this opportunity to sit down and talk with you. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day. You got a short trip here, and I'm really pleased that you took the time to come and speak with me for thejazzshed.com today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
So you've been here. You're about to play your second show of a two-show stopover here in Vancouver. I know you've been here before, but you know, how is it going so far? How did it feel last night?
Well, last night was great. I love playing at Frankie's. It's kind of a homespun place. And Corey Weeds, who is the true champion for jazz music here in Vancouver, and of course Coastal Jazz and Blues, they do such a wonderful job of cultivating an audience of very, very enthusiastic people. So when you come back, you see a lot of the same faces from previous shows, and they become friends. They're people. We see them in New York at Smalls, and then it becomes a nice circle. So the energy is always special. They really love it. And as an artist, it's quite an experience to be able to play for those kind of people, because it gives you a lot of freedom to just, you have their attention.
So you're not a young boy, but you're not necessarily a grizzled veteran. You're here now. You're really doing something in the jazz industry. You're a mover and shaker. As somebody who's also been interested in listening to jazz and trying to play jazz for a period of time, I'm always impressed with people like yourself who have a passion for the music that we refer to as jazz. But I'm very curious to know why. So why do you pursue the music as a musician, and over and above that, run two jazz clubs in New York City, among probably many other things you do? You've got Smalls and Mesro. So why do you do it? What's the compulsion?
Well, that's a big question. You know, I'm a jazz musician, so first and foremost, it's always been for me about the piano and playing the piano and playing jazz music. I have a strong connection to the tradition from New York City for the jazz community and that scene there. I came up there, you know, I grew up in it. And it's always been my endeavor to play great jazz piano and to study the music and to be part of that tradition. It's very much alive in New York. And when I was coming up, I, you know, basically from the age of 19 or so, I was playing professionally and making my living playing jazz gigs. And in those days in New York, you could play all over the place in little restaurants, cafes, clubs. You know, I would make my living as a local jazz musician playing. You play hours of solo piano or duo in restaurants or bar mitzvahs or, you know, club dates, as they call them, which really meant like social events for country clubs and all kinds of things, you know, anything I could to make my living and continue to study music and try to play the piano. And I came from a generation of jazz musicians that all became very, very successful in their own right. You know, guys that I went to school with include Brad Meldow and Larry Goldings and Peter Bernstein and Roy Hargrove and Jesse Davis. And, you know, there's a whole slew of guys I went to school with at that time that all became very well-known jazz musicians in today's. And so it was a high standard as a young person to be in that environment, and also a very competitive one. And what happens sometimes with an artist is you have a strong ambition when you're young to be great, but then the reality of what it means to live starts to have impact on you as you get older. It becomes more and more costly. And if you're not rewarded sufficiently in your own sense of gratification, if you have that, because ultimately it becomes an ego-driven desire, you can become bitter. Mm-hmm. Once you become, you know, in this position where you're very bitter, you become angry, and then you blame the environment, you blame the clubs, you blame the club owners, you blame your fellow musicians, you blame your wife, you blame mm-hmm. your girlfriend, you know, till you become this mass of darkness, you know,
right,
a wraith of jazz where you can't grow anymore because you've become hateful.
Yes.
I felt like I was getting into that position at one point in my life where I had spent so much time practicing and studying and still not achieving what I saw as what my other, you know, my same guys I went to school with were getting, and I wasn't getting, say, in my mind. It began to make me angry, like I said. It began to affect me to the point where I kind of had a bottoming out experience where I realized that I couldn't continue in the mindset that I was in if I really wanted to take music into the long term. And it was a revelation, but I made a conscious decision that I would abandon the idea of being a professional musician and abandon all my aspirations for recognition, tours, record deals, whatever it I aspired to in the past. I was going to forego that and just focus on what I liked about playing the piano. And if I had to earn my living some other way, I would do so. But mostly I just continued to do what I did, which was to teach and play little gigs around town. But the mindset now was so different for me because it became about, what do I want to play? What am I? You know,
right.
As a young jazz musician, you're caught up in trying to learn styles and assimilate to styles, and you're trying on different people's clothing, but it doesn't quite look right on you. And, you know, what happens in jazz is the need to reach this level of self-realization through, after a long period of study, you become yourself. But that was yet to come for me. At that time, I was just still, like, frustratingly trying to figure out why it wasn't working out.
Right.
And it was my own problem. I was creating the barriers with my own ego. When I abandoned the idea of, like, trying to make it and be famous or whatever and just kind of go underground, as it were, and it freed me up from that, but it didn't necessarily free me up from my own ego yet. Finally, when I was about 40 years old, I decided to go back to finish my master's degree, which I did at the University of New York. Now, during that time, from 1994, I should preface everything by saying that one of the things that's always been in New York City, as long as I can remember, is clubs. What I mean by jazz clubs, I mean like social gathering spots, not necessarily a place where people are ushered in, watch a show, and then are escorted out. I'm talking about a communal experience where you arrive, people know who you are, it's a large group of people, you know, and jazz music is the background, it's what's happening. Like when I was a kid, I grew up at the Village Gate, which was a big jazz club run by a great club owner named Art DeLugoff, and I was friends with his son, Raphael DeLugoff, who's a great piano player in his own right. And the Village Gate was a thriving community of people there. They had a terrace level with jazz going on and jam sessions. They had an upstairs with a comedy club, a downstairs with a big theater. It was an amazing thing till it finally got shut down by the negative forces of our economy post 9/11 and became a Rite Aid. It's desecration. It was like, it's like the Romans building on top of the temples of the ancient ones, you know, just to desecrate.
Right.
Sad. But fortunately, a man named Mitch Borden, who's now my partner and one of my dearest friends in the world, decided to open up a club he called Smalls on the corner of West 10th Street and 7th Avenue. And he got this basement space for next to nothing, and it was an old kitchen in there, and it was really, really junky. And he had some dough. He tried to trust a guy with getting him his liquor license and ended up getting ripped off, so he couldn't get the liquor license. So he decided instead of getting a liquor license, he would forego a liquor license, which would allow him to let people just bring their own beer.
Okay. Well, that's an interesting policy.
Yeah.
Not every city allows the...
Well, at this time in New York, this was still 1994, so it was before Big Brother really got his claws on us and took over our minds, but it was still, you know, it was the end of that era.
Wow.
And Mitch decided to just basically let it run 24/7 with Bring Your Own Beer, and it created a vortex of basically like young people who just wanted to get hammered and hang out, and like, you know, derelicts and old timers who had nowhere else to go.
Right.
But it also spawned a generation of young jazz musicians who embraced it as their home for playing.
Right.
And that included guys like Joshua Redman, Kurt Rosenwinkel and Jason Linder, Omer Avital, Peter Bernstein, Brad Meldow, you know, Chris Byers and Ari Rowland, and just so many guys that were at that time young, in their early 20-somethings, but because it was such a dive, that was a place for them to hang. And they ended up becoming, of course, defining the next generation of jazz music. Now mm-hmm. they're all well, very well known.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the environment of Smalls. And I was involved, too. I had my own steady show on Tuesday nights. It started about 2 a.m. and went to 6.
Wow.
So it was a breaker. I would go to bed and get up and then go downtown and go to my gig. And
wow.
But Mitch and I became very good friends during that time, and I got to be close to him. Then what happened was in 2001, there was an event on September 11th that decimated the lower part of our city.
Yes.
A very bizarre event, I'd say, in American history, and one that's still to this day very little understood.
Mm-hmm.
And I could go on for hours on that, but I don't want to get in trouble. But
We'll do something offline.
Okay. Yeah, I you know, I was there the day it happened, and it was a very depressing day for New York. And yeah. it foretold even worse future for New York, which was the decimation of New York's culture, which was because I think 9/11, if anything, and I'm not going to say who was responsible or why. I have my theories that I, like I said, I don't want to get too into, but it did represent a changing of the guard in New York City. And so what happened was across the board, commercial property went from very, very low or reasonably low to insanely high.
Right.
Because of the way the commercial laws work in New York City, those leases are not protected for the renter, only the owner.
Right.
He can kick you out. Unlike tenant leases, where the tenant actually has a considerable amount of rights.
Yes.
Businesses is the complete opposite. You have nothing, and they can kick you out. They can change your rent. Whenever the lease is up, they can do whatever they want, essentially. Mm. So after 9/11, that was when Giuliani came in, and he essentially opened the floodgates to corporations just come in and grab land grab, and the character of the city changed. At Smalls, what happened was the rent went from about, it was like $900 a month at the time for this basement.
That sounds unbelievable for Manhattan.
Well, this was 94.
Yeah.
You know, still, it was still like, you know, a different kind of thing. And then it went to basically $9,000 a month.
Wow. Wow.
And for Mitch, whose model really was just a donation at the door and didn't sell anything, or, you know, it was just a kind of a death blow. He
right.
ended up moving the business to another place right around the corner called the Fat Cat, which was a billiard hall, and partnered up with that guy for a while. And then the space that was Smalls got taken by another guy who was a Brazilian, I'd say, underworld character, somehow managed to get it licensed for a liquor license, which is an amazing thing. I don't know how he did that, greased some palms. And then he put in a Brazilian-style bar in what was Smalls and called it the Rio Bar.
Wow.
And then no one came to there for the whole time. I mean, anytime anyone showed up there, they'd be, is this Smalls? He'd be like, no, now this is the Rio Bar. They'd be like, later. I mean, we're talking like televisions everywhere, and it was awful.
Yeah.
That went on for about a year or so, and then he approached Mitch and said, look, you know, I'm going out of business here. How would you feel if we reopened it as Smalls? I'll own it, and you can manage it and book the bands. So Mitch said, okay, we'll do it. And it kind of became a hybrid Rio Bar Smalls for a very weird period, but Mitch called me up and asked if I could supply a piano for the club, which I did, in exchange for getting my regular Sunday night slot back with my own band,
mm-hmm.
which in fact includes Joe Magnarelli, who's playing with me tonight at Frankie's.
Right.
And that went on for a little bit until finally this guy who was the owner of Smalls came to Mitch and was like, it's a terrible business. I'm not making any money. Enough's enough. You know, do you want to buy back the business from me? Otherwise, I'm going to just sell it to somebody. And Mitch came to me and was like, what do you think? This was just at the time that I had said when I was finishing my master's degree
mm-hmm.
at the State University of New York. And
was that a master's in music?
Yeah, master's okay. in piano performance, jazz piano okay. performance, which I was finishing. I had one semester left. And then all of a sudden, Mitch is like, why don't you help me buy Smalls? Why don't you buy Smalls? And I was like, wow, like, I knew that if I didn't try to jump in, Smalls would basically really be done at this point, because this guy wasn't kidding around. And at the same time, it just was like, I had no idea what I was really doing. I owned an apartment up there in Harlem, which I had bought also in the 90s for $40,000.
Wow.
And
just sounds insane.
Yeah, that was the old days. And then at that point, I could mortgage it for considerably more, which is what I decided to do. So, you know, I was kind of on a path to try to get a teaching job, really. That was my advance at that point. It was like 40 years old, and I didn't, you know, I had been playing in New York for so long at this point, and I kind of saw the handwriting on the wall in terms of stability or any kind of normal life. And so I was just finishing that degree, and then this thing came with Smalls, and I had to make a decision which direction I wanted to go in. And I went to ask my dad, actually. That's how I did it. I went up to see my father, who was a professor, actually. He's a retired professor. He was at Columbia University, kind of a real strict disciplinarian guy, you know, brusque and, you know, no nonsense for the most part. And so I went to see him, and I told him the whole situation. I was like, you know, I have this chance to buy this bar here, or I could be finishing up my degree and trying to get a teaching position in a university. And he's listening to both sides, and I'm convinced I know what he's going to say, of course, which is just, you know, like, Michael, it's time for you to face reality and get a, you know, get a real job. And so he's sitting there thinking about it for a minute, and he goes, you know, buy the bar. And I was so surprised. I said, what? He's like, man, just buy the bar. I said, what? Are you serious? He's like, I'll tell you. He goes, like, a life in academics is such hell, I wouldn't wish it on anyone. He's like,
wow.
Whatever you do, don't become a teacher. He's like, collect trash if you have to, but don't go to teaching in college.
Wow.
I was like, holy, whoa. Like, it was so funny, actually, but shocking.
Wow.
But my dad was like, please, yeah, just go ahead, buy the bar. You'll be much happier.
What a blessing that is, in a way.
It was a great moment in my life where my dad just said, took me by total surprise.
Yeah.
And so then I did. I mortgaged the apartment, and I bought the club and became partners with Mitchell Board, and that was in September of 2007.
Wow.
And then my life took a whole different turn in a way that I could never have imagined. I was thrust into this, well, you know, everyone says jazz club has all these romantic connotations, but the truth is it's just a bar.
Yes.
Like, it's a bar business. That means ordering beers and wines and liquors and keeping your stock and your inventory and soda gun deliveries, and you got to, you know, napkins and straws and all this shit you have to keep going, and cleaning up every day and vomit in the bathrooms, and you know, sales tax, and you know, liability insurance for your workers, and paying payroll, and, you know, the legal shit, the tax thing. It was just, before that, I'd be like, yeah, I'll make the gig for $100 and come home, and, you know.
This sounds like a familiar story, because I interviewed Corey Weeds 2 years ago when he was about to start this Frankie's Jazz Club thing and his partnership with Coastal Jazz. And he talked about his experience with the cellar and why he was happy to be out of it. You've had this experience. You still are involved with the operations of Smalls, as far as I know.
Yes, I am. Yeah, intimately so, as we should say.
And so I know we could probably have volumes of fantastic stories. Some, you know, you're documenting the music at Smalls, but some of this backstory, I'm sure there's hours and hours of incredible stories. But I'm really curious. One of the things I try to get at here when I'm talking to people, and you started to allude to it earlier, is how do you balance the first passion, the motivation for why you're where you are today, which is a love of the music and your aspirations as a jazz piano player, with all of the time and energy that's required to run Smalls, in your case? The how do you make your living and still find that space and time and energy and attention for the music?
Well, the thing is, I've had the good fortune of having a long life of musical time to study with great teachers and amazing, you know, I started really studying jazz piano in earnest when I was about 18, 19 years old. Mm-hmm. And Smalls came into my life when I was 40.
Okay.
I'm 51 now. So, wow. But between the age of 18 and the age of 40, I became immersed in jazz study life.
Mm-hmm.
I went deep in, as they say, as you must, as all the people that I know who are great do, which is just like a commitment to practicing and years and years of it. Now, mm-hmm. I sacrifice certain things I think that other people would consider normal, like, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of relationships, perhaps, or just quality of life. You know, in return for that, I just focused on learning how to play the piano as best as I could and also understanding what jazz was. And it just took me a long time to really get to the point where I even felt that I had a good understanding of it, even to this day. But I can say by the time I was in my 40s, I already had it pretty well under control. So that meant that what I didn't have under control when I was 40s was my ego issues.
Right.
But I was at the position where I could take on another responsibility and understand how important it was and apply myself in that way and not lose the music. Now, if it had happened, say, 10 years earlier, I don't think I would have been able to handle it.
Right.
I needed to have this period that I took in my life to get to where I had to be musically so that I could get it together,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I needed credibility as a jazz musician to make Smalls work. It's not for someone who doesn't know what they're doing.
Right.
It takes someone who really knows what the fuck they're doing and earning the respect of every musician that comes through there, because otherwise it implodes.
You
know, it has to be balanced in a way that's key. And like I said, the jazz scene in New York is like, it's just this organic thing that happens naturally with musicians participating with each other. So if you're an observer of the jazz scene and even a participant, say, then you can start to understand quickly who's who and where they are and
mm-hmm.
why.
Mm-hmm.
And you can let the scene dictate itself to you rather than you trying to say, oh, I heard your CD, you're great. You
right.
can find greatness right in front of your nose,
right.
you know, but it's a process that takes a lot of dedication and really being it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that makes sense, but it's like
making the scene.
Yeah, and a community of musicians who are participating in each other's artwork and everyone being aware of that.
Right.
You know, there's a phenomenon that happens, and I've witnessed it several times in the jazz scene in New York, is that a young musician will emerge. And people will have heard of him from all over, and it'll be almost like you heard the stampede coming off in the distance, and then
right.
it gets louder and louder, and then finally this kid arrives, and you're also like, wow.
Yeah.
And then he's in the stratosphere, and
yeah.
it's just the force of his talent and creating a wave of, you know, he's not passing out CDs or there's no hype in any regard except from
mm-hmm.
the reputation that he evokes from the musicians. It's
mm-hmm.
a phenomenon. I don't know where else it exists and what other field, but in jazz that's very strong.
Yes.
You know, where it's just like you, it doesn't matter who you are, what you look like, if you can play and you're true, then people love you. They
yes.
they do. And no, every musician in town knows who's good
right.
and who's bad.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I tell people, like if you suck, just accept the fact that you suck and get back to the practice room, you know, really. And if you can really play, you don't need to ask for a gig. It's
yeah.
as simple as that.
Yeah.
You know? So, like I said, this kind of, I preface saying all this by the fact that I spent a long time in that network as a musician, and also a musician who couldn't play that great maybe, and facing that and watching and growing and also growing as an artist. Now, once I got to Smalls' stage in my life, I began to be immersed in the responsibility of what it meant to feasibly run a bar business in New York City and do it right.
Right.
Make sure everything's paid correctly. Pay everybody. Really, that's what you do. You pay everybody all the damn time. And if there's anything left at the end of the day, that's yours. But, of course, government gets 40% or whatever. So it's really like it's a hard-ass thing. Now, any business owner you can ask is the same. Today I was down at that oyster bar right near the hotel having some oysters and watching the guy manager there. And I was just, like, checking out how they work behind their oyster bar. And I was like, this is an excellent outfit of you know, I sympathize so strongly. I admire seeing good networks of people working together. You know, Smalls is special because it's so particular. So, like, for example, in my team, all my managers are also great jazz musicians in their own right.
Right.
I find it necessary to only hire professional musicians in the managerial roles for a very specific reason. One, they know what's going on. They understand the environment. They're not confused by what the deal is.
They care about the product, so that kind
they
of drives
are,
their behavior.
They are. The guys that they're managing there are their friends.
Yeah.
You know, just like me. It's the same thing. Like, the guys that I'm managing are all my friends, and I'm in a tight position because people tend to really want to hate you fast. You know, that's why Smalls has become a spiritual practice for me, in the sense, and that I've learned from Mitch. Like, Mitch Borden is a spiritual saint, really. He's a saintly man. Everyone that knows him says, will say the same. I endeavor to emulate Mitch, but with a little more business savvy than Mitch had. Mitch gave away the farm, you know.
Right.
I don't intend to give away the farm, but I do intend to give back to the community as much as I can.
Right.
You know, the one thing that I implemented right away when I took over Smalls in September of 2007, was the Smalls Live archiving project. And I put in some machinery to just basically record everything.
Right.
I made it very, very, you know, touch and go, so that every manager could easily learn what had to happen, which would just set in motion essentially a device that recorded everything, audio as well as video, and also live streamed. And so we started first when the technology wasn't that amazing yet for live streaming, and now the technology is incredible, I'd say. Anyone can have a full-on TV studio right in their club, you know.
You've revised the technology or renewed it one or two or three times as the technology improved?
Yeah, no. Well, at first we started with just a laptop and a webcam, like a little ball USB thing. But as it evolved, we figured out, because part of the challenge for us is that we don't want a cameraman.
Right.
We want it to be completely turnkey. In other words, the system, it's like a computer. You press a few buttons and it goes, and that's that.
Right.
And that's what we've developed. So it the product is something that's not as good as if you had, like, real camera guys mixing. And but for a day-to-day kind of grinding it out thing, it's worked very well for us.
Right.
And so we upgraded that. We finally moved to a new platform recently that's given us a lot more stability in terms of streaming. You know, that's something that you need to look into, is what they call the, you know, your the way you transmit your stream. And we've also been, the other thing that we did is we've been archiving everything, and finally now in the last couple of years, onto the Amazon S3 server that we have for Smalls Live. So now literally all of our data is on this huge machine database. And so what we've created also is an ability for people who are what we call supporting members. And a supporting member essentially pays a small amount each month. They get access to the archive.
Right.
The live streams are free from anyone that signs up. Anyone that wants to can sign up. But the archive itself, we're looking for support and actually moving Smalls Live into almost a non-for-profit thing, where we're trying to get people to support what we have. And what happens with the archive is that as people listen to the past shows, all the artists that are on the show are credited with a number of minutes listened to. So at the end of a pay period, you have a total number of minutes for the entire archive, and then each artist has their own individual minutes listened to, which becomes divided and creates a fraction that is a percentage of the total revenue that we collect from our supporting members.
Right.
And then we distribute that as royalties to all those artists, depending on So what's happened, and we've done this now three times, we're about to have our fourth payout, which is essentially for the entire year of 2017. We'll be distributing about $14,000, almost $15,000 to the artists, which for us is a lot of money at this point. Mm-hmm. If we could really make it happen, it would be an amazing thing. Now, what's really fascinating about that is once you run the statistics to see who, like, number one is to number, because we have 2,000-something musicians in our archive, right?
Wow.
But in the top, say, 30 or 40 guys, they're actually getting some nice checks.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
The top few guys are making, like, $400 or $500 each, you know, out of that kitty. And, you know, even down the line, 80. Now, our position is always, like, you take a look at a company like Spotify or Apple Music, and what are they actually paying in royalties? You get pennies, fractions of a penny.
Right, right.
Our system is based on basically a relationship between Smalls Live and the artist that we consider to be symbiotic rather than ownership based.
Right.
The artist has 100% ownership of the show.
Right.
The artist owns 100% of the publishing and all the any of that.
Right.
The artist also has the right to not make the show public in our archive if they just want to have it private if they don't like it.
Right.
If it becomes public, then as our listeners check it out, they're credited with time. And then they get their percentage of the royalty payment. So we try to, like, take the operation costs first and then distribute the rest of the artists. And so It's slowly getting off the ground. We're about to revise the website to make it even more kind of like that. But a big part of my mission throughout the last 10 years has been to just kind of to document and propagate this massive amount of work, because You wouldn't believe how dense and how variegated this archive is. We're talking about every show at Smalls from September 2007 to today. And each night you're talking about 2 to 3 bands, 4 bands on the weekends.
Wow.
You know?
It's almost unfathomable, really. I mean, to think about how much music is there. No one person could possibly traverse all of it. Well, I mean, if they were very keen and dedicated and had lots of time. But it's staggering to think of that amount of recorded music that you've collected over the years and what a legacy it is, and what a product it can be, and it's impressive to hear that you're everything you're trying to do with that.
I'm not sure what the end result will be. You know, it's kind of like message in a bottle for me. You know, it's like I want it to be like in the future, 100 years hence, say, after all of us are long gone, that this document will exist of like 10 years worth, right. 15 years worth of Smalls Jazz Club, and that people can study it, find, you know, because there's so much music in there right now that's it's really quite amazing.
Well, you know, in my own small way, no pun intended, I don't have the time to dedicate, and I don't have that past of having committed like you did, but to me, the music of jazz, which I see is still very much alive, I want it to be documented properly, including conversations about jazz. There's a lot of recorded music. The conversations that people have about jazz are, you know, it's an area that you can go down the wrong path on, and I'm trying to have the right conversations about jazz. And people like yourself are, you know, very special and somewhat rare, and I appreciate what you're doing with Smalls, and I appreciate you taking the time this afternoon.
Oh, yeah, of course.
It's been absolutely...
Well, I'm always glad to share it. I mean, you know, it's kind of a multifaceted thing. I mean, it all gets back to the original question you asked, is like, how do I do it? A lot of people ask me, like, I don't see how you do it. And my response is that, you know, for one thing, I don't do it alone. So I always give credit to, of course, Mitch, and also my staff, which is, they're all fantastic. And I have a lot of people that are involved with me, from my bar staff and my managers, also to my office where I have my assistants and my video editors and, you know, my tech people. And so there's a lot of people that are working with me. I'm just trying to kind of keep it focused. You know, managing the clubs is something that I really like doing. I like going down to the bars, greeting the customers, seeing them. Everything that's involved with a bar, I like. I like bartending, actually. I don't mind doing that either. I like getting behind the bar and serving drinks, you know, so I'm okay with that. Piano is still my number one thing, and it's become the refuge for me. Like, the thing that's happened with Smalls is because once the responsibilities took over on my mind, when I finally got to play music, it was like a relief from the pressure of right. what I had to do previously. Now, up to that point, I had spent a lot of time. If I had a play, I'd have a lot of anxiety. I'd worry about who was in the room. I'd worry about if I warmed up, if I didn't do this, if I didn't do that. This now, it's like when I get a chance to play, man, I'm just like, yeah. Let me at it. Let me play a piano and just derive the joy of it. You know, and I'm still, of course, critical, but I'm becoming more and more aware of what I am. So I think the goals that I've set for myself musically originally are bearing fruit, you know, like being able to come on tour with these guys and play at clubs like Frankie's and have that audience. You know, it's like Joe Magnarelli is one of my oldest friends in New York, and we've played together from my very earliest years in bands together and everything. And we were just walking last night after the gig, and I said, man, we achieved our goals in life. We've done it, Joe.
Well, I was going to say at the beginning of the interview when you, I didn't want to interrupt your stream, but when you said you decided to give up on being a professional piano player, I was going to interject and say, well, you failed on that regard. From my perspective,
well, let me correct something,
though. It
seems
like you're a professional jazz piano player.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, but professional means making a living playing
sure.
this music.
Sure.
Now, truth be told, like a tour like this is one where I won't really make any money.
Right.
You know, paying the guys correctly, and I organized it along with the guys that helped me out on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
But it's for me.
Yeah.
So I'm coming out here for my own enjoyment to right. play this music with guys that I love. It's a little bit different than being, you know, going to a job that you might hate. And believe
right.
me, I've been on tours where it's not about just like how much fun I'm having, but none of that. You get back on the bus and you get on the gig and, you know, da-da-da.
Yeah.
So, yeah, maybe I'm a professional. Not really, though. Honestly, it's like it's not that I'm an amateur, but professional is a weird word because
yeah.
it takes away the humanity. You know what I am? It's like I'm an artist. So I want to.
You're a serious player. I see it from the perspective of the art of jazz. I think you've, I would say you've arrived. You're in the realm of serious jazz piano players. You're a serious jazz piano player.
Well, always been my goal.
Yeah.
It's as simple as pie. That, and that's why I said to Joe last night. I said we achieved it, and now it's just about an eye to the future because now that the personal goal may have been met. I still have a wider goal of the mission of Smalls, which is dissemination of music worldwide, and ultimately the grand mission of world peace through music, because I always say it at my shows, it is possible. We can unify through music. It isn't impossible. Jazz is a unifying art form because it speaks to all culture and all people, if they can hear it. Like I always joke about it. That, you know, perhaps there's people out there that can't hear jazz and they're the ones that we have to be afraid of, you know. But it's really more about who are we as jazz musicians, jazz lovers, jazz fans. What is it that makes us the same? What do we love?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've always found jazz people, as I call them, to be very intelligent, very curiously intellectual, very spiritually oriented, if not necessarily religious, but aware, compassionate people. You know, funny as hell people, you know, like people who might have problems with drugs or drinking, you know, that might even take them out, you know,
mm-hmm.
that's not something that, you know, but never like cruel people or mean people really or close-minded people or really angry people, you know, like
mm-hmm.
that it seems to eliminate certain kind of thing. And so what does that say? Well, that we can start to recognize who we are and we can also make changes in the world by exerting our influence as spiritually strong beings. You know, the evil ones exert their influence through means of, you know, propaganda and
force and power.
We can't fight that. Definitely can't fight that on their own terms. You
mm-hmm.
know, we'll never win, but we can win in our own spiritual battles against them, which we'll always win because you can't. You know, human spirit is like if you go see an asphalt parking lot and there's a crack in the asphalt and there's a kind of a grass chute coming straight up, that's the human
yeah.
spirit. You can't really pave over it entirely. It'll always burst through. I'm convinced of that. And as much as those corporate guys want to take over, let them try. They can have it, but they won't always win. I think that we're seeing some things. Well, I hope so. We'll see. Who knows, man? That's why we archive, so that maybe some future Android can interpret the music.
It's amazing. That's the picture you paint of Smalls representing this green shoot of hope out of the concrete, you know, cruelty of, you know, capitalist Manhattan, which is full of beautiful, wonderful people. But it also represents sort of, you know, this capitalist machine. And here's Smalls.
You know. Smalls is a capitalist machine, too. I mean, it's like, the thing is, it's like I always say to people, like, business is not bad.
No.
You know, but greed is bad. It's all like, you know, like, it's okay to make some money, but you don't need to make all the fucking money all the time. Like, you know, you can give back.
Yeah.
It makes people happier. You know, it would make your workers happier. You know, why do you need to have all the money all the time? You know, I don't think so. Landlords could learn well to, like, all right, maybe I shouldn't rent this space for such a highly prohibitive price that nothing will happen, that'll remain empty. Maybe I'll find a qualified guy that can really make a go of a good business here and aid the community. You know, why is that kind of thinking so foreign?
You know, it's interesting. There's a thread that's coming together here. Something about jazz music, and when it's performed at its best, in my opinion, it's a group effort, and it's about egoless collaboration with a common language spoken at a very high and eloquent level, where you put your ego aside, and you have to have big ears and a big heart. And to me, everybody on the bandstand has to win, which sounds to me like the capitalist endeavor that you're striving for with everybody in your business. You want them all to succeed.
Well, we're banking spiritual dollars, not U.S. currency. You know what I mean? Like, we got a big fat bank account right now that's the size of Google, you know, in terms of spiritual dollars.
Yeah.
As far as American, good old American dollars, not so much, but that's okay. You know what I mean? Like, that's fine. It's like, it's about a goal, you know? And the thing is, Smalls is more of a art center kind of a thing, you know? I mean, it's still a bar as its furnace for making that rent payments and all that stuff. It'd be cool to maybe find a place where I could have people support it through donations and they benefit from some kind of tax break or something. Mm-hmm. I think that's a future possibility, you know? For the time being, it's running at gangbuster levels. You know, it's become a iconic place now. You know, I remember not that long ago, have empty nights down there where we would, you know, just waiting, and now it's not the case.
That's hard to imagine, empty nights.
I used to do shows on Tuesday nights. We had solo piano shows on Tuesdays because we couldn't really afford to put a band in that slot yet until people wouldn't come around till 10 o'clock or something. Now it's just a line before we even open the doors. And I attribute that to two factors, one being that there's now a legitimate jazz tourism industry in New York, I'd say, worldwide, because a lot of people like this music. They consider it American culture. They want to experience it. And Smalls has reached the state where it's now in quite a few, if not all, the tour books that they will buy. If you buy a copy of Lonely Planet or Retour or any of these books that they have, there's quite a few good books that people will buy from if they're in France. They go to the jazz section, there's Smalls listed along with maybe the Village Vanguard or something, and I see this over and over again.
Yeah.
And it's created for us this quite a huge business. But what's nice is the people that are coming are coming because they want to hear real music and they're expecting good quality. So I'm programming for them, like, regardless of who you come to hear one night, you know, that it's going to definitely be good. May not be to my taste, but it'll definitely be of a quality jazz experience. And then Mesro is our new club. We opened that about 4 years ago, right across the street from Smalls, with the idea that it originally would just be a holding place for our crowds that we're getting at Smalls, because we couldn't keep lines anymore. And then Mesro became a thing of its own, really. It now runs kind of currently with Smalls, but it has a different vibe altogether. Greenwich Village is a funny place because, you know, I'm walking down around in Vancouver. I love to walk around in Vancouver because I love seeing all the old spots that are kind of run down even. Yeah. I find it remarkable when I go to like a Skid Row area or areas where it's really bad, and I can see a glimpse of that, because New York City has a different phenomenon happening where areas of the city are being devastated by wealth rather than poverty.
Yes.
And that's what's happened in Greenwich Village. Is if you take a walk around Greenwich Village, 50% of the storefronts are shuttered, not because of the poor people that are coming to the neighborhood, but because of the rich people, and no normal person can run a business there anymore.
They're catering to a different crowd, and those buildings are deemed to be not suitable for that new demographic that's moving in.
They're holding out for a lot of money that they can get. Yeah. I guess they can get. I mean, I'm wondering, though, because I'm watching that property in that neighborhood, and it's not like it's opening and closing. It's just sitting closed.
Yeah.
We had a cafe that was in the neighborhood for years and years. I'm talking since the 20s, across the street from Smalls, called the Riviera Cafe, closed this year. And I went to have a tour of the property because it's such a great space. But they're looking for $41,000 a month for that spot, which is maybe doable. But, man, what a pressure. Holy moly. You know, and it's a shame that a space like that couldn't even somehow they work something out where neighborhoods could continue to have culture, that instead of it becoming an Armani store or something, which is probably destined for, or even a, God forbid, a Chase Bank or another bank or Dwayne Reed. That's what you get all over New York is Chase Bank, Dwayne Reed, Dunkin' Donuts, and Starbucks, because that's the only ones that can afford to just get that property. All the cafes are gone and bookstores. It's decimation by wealth.
Thank God we have Spike Willner to the rescue with Smalls fighting the good fight.
Thank you. Yes, I'll try my best.
I appreciate it.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Cool.
It's
it was
been a pleasure.
Great talking to you.
Thank you.
I hope it's good.
It'll be good.
Okay, great. Thank you.